300 watts. You can find them with 1,000 watts, 3,000 watts, 5,000 watts, and nobody wants them if you know where to look at it. And all you need is just either to limit, go through the attenuator between your radio and the input of that, so you could go with those milliwatts that is required to steer it, or just somehow skip that first module and go to the finish amplifier that is driven by a few watts. Entering here.
Well, Wesley, you know, one thing that amateurs are well known for are repurposing old used equipment that the original users no longer felt was useful to them and turn it into something different. So, you know, I mean, you're doing something in the fine spirit of amateur radio, repurposing something for a different purpose. Nuclear magnetic resonance is a fascinating subject. It has to do with the angular spin quantum levels of protons and neutrons and precession and how you orient them through a fixed magnetic field and then sweep the radio frequency field for the resonance where they pick up the energy of the photons and flip to the opposite spin state. But I would like to actually try to get to a mailbag question before the space report, Wesley.
Of course. What I would love to see is if you decide go to tomographic imaging for non-medical applications like soil, plants, using MRI or PET, or different kind of applications of that technology, but for investigating of matter, not necessarily medical field. Thank you very much, and I don't talk anymore. Go to the mailbox.
Okay, thank you very much, Wesley. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control for the LIMAR technical net that meets here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. It's been going strong since 1982, and it continues to go on. We had a mailbag question from a listener. Chris C. Has been listening to the technical net for many years. As a matter of fact, he visited us via the chat room during Dick K2RIW's radio wake and promised that in memory of Dick, he was going to go and get himself a tech license, and he's actually gone and done it. He hasn't gotten his license yet. He just passed the test a few days ago, and he sent me an email where he kind of threw out a question. He's pretty much decided on the equipment to use for his ham shack. He's going to get a 7300 ICOM for HF. He's going to get the 96 or 9700 UHF VHF, and he's going to get an NFED antenna, and he's going to get a triplex, tri-band UHF VHF antenna and such. And he has a question, though, that he wanted me to share with you guys, and I would be interested in hearing. It's really an opinion. It's not yes or no. It's kind of like what you've decided upon in years of practicing this subtle art of amateur radio. Let me drop, and I'll read his little mailbag question. Okay, so Chris wrote, I'd love to hear what type of microphone most experienced hams prefer to use on a base station. A handheld mic, a desk mic, or a boom mic with either a foot PTT switch or a hand PTT switch. So I open it up to all you guys that have been doing this for many, many, many years. Anyone want to voice their opinion of what they prefer? I tend to think it's a combination of what you're used to, what you have, and the proper tools for the proper job. But let's see if someone has something to talk about on this subject.
90% of the guys use the microphones that came with the radio.
everybody, but those aren't the 90% that listen to the Limar Technical Net. We have a lot of independent people out there who come up with all kinds of interesting solutions, things that aren't even thought of as a problem by other people. So in the case of, I would agree with you, the general tendency is to just pull out the hand mic that's almost always stuck in the box, plug it in, and just go from there. But a lot of us, I'm sure you didn't do that, I didn't do that, just interested to see if anyone would like to talk about their sensibilities of what type of a microphone they found to be the most useful in a base station environment, because it's obviously different if you're mobile. So if anyone has anything that they'd like to share with us, that would be nice.
KC2FYJ.
Yes, Harry.
I can't speak for anyone else, but if you're, and I, my personal feeling is it depends to a large degree on whether or not you plan to be logging, whether you plan to be doing DXing, whether you plan to do contesting. If you're going to do contesting and you want to do a lot of logging for when you're rag chewing as well, a foot switch and a boom mic are ideal because it leaves your hands free to work your computer or your paper and pencil or however you want to log. Back to Ned.
Okay, Harry, I agree with you. The only addition is I find a headset to be even nicer for that because you don't even have to worry of where your face is pointed.
Very true. I haven't found a headset that's comfortable for me, so that's why I continue to use the boom mic and the foot pedal. But that's a perfectly valid and viable option as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think I had a conversation with someone either last week or the week before that had a Heil headset. I bought Heil headsets. I find that the clamping pressure, it just gives me worse of a headache than anything else. I found, though, that there's a company called Radio Sport, Arlen Communications, I believe, and I have a nice headset from them. It's very reminiscent to a airplane or helicopter-like headset, and it has interchangeable microphones, and it's really beautifully well-made. In addition, I have something called a HiQ Lite 2, which is a very, very lightweight headset that isn't very good to kind of get through the noise of HF, but I use it regularly here because it works beautifully for FM, and it's light on the head, and again, I don't have to figure out where my mouth is in relation to my boom mic. I do have a boom mic. I have a bunch of different mics, and I have a foot pedal. I have a hand trigger. For whatever reason, I've grown to really be attached to my Heil hand trigger. I've even bought replacement switches because once the switch went bad on me, so I have some replacement switches. But, you know, it's the same way as trackballs versus mice versus track points. It's whatever you get muscle memory for in many ways.
BDH would comment.
Yes, John.
Well, for VHF, for 2 meters, for my Kenwood TR-751, I use the stock mic that came with it. It has the touch tone pad on the back of it. However, for HF, with my Japan radio company, NSD-515, I have the old D-104 classic microphone, which is very nice because I can switch to a Vox by just slipping the clip up on the push to talk and put the NSD-515 in Vox mode, and it's good for, you know, chasing DX. But I do like the D-104, kind of the classic microphone that I picked up at one of the hamventions about 15, 20 years ago. Go ahead.
Very good, John. We're kindred spirits. As I talk, I'm looking behind me, and I have two D-104s, a black and gold model, and the chrome-plated version. I was not a big fan, though, of the audio quality. It tends to historically have a very high impedance. I don't know if it's a piezoelectric element, but it was kind of tinny to my ear. But there are people out there that sell little kits to adjust the preamp and change the microphone element. And I've done that to my D-104, as you might consider a travesty. But I prefer the sound of the newer microphone elements to the older ones, at least on the rigs that I use.
Yeah, I've heard that comment before, and I did have that checked out. For some reason, I don't know if it has to do with the input audio circuits in this Japan Radio Company transmitter, but it seems to match very well. And because I've had I had an opportunity to listen to the audio on one of those loop around stations where you could hear yourself come back. And I didn't notice any of that tinny quality at all with the audio. I think it has something to do with the audio input circuits on a Japan Radio Company equipment. Incidentally, I'm very disappointed to hear that JRC, Japan Radio Company, has gotten out of the amateur radio equipment. They did make some very nice equipment several years ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's an ongoing trend. I mean, Tokyo High Power was a great company, made beautiful equipment, and it just went bankrupt. And unfortunately, I can't see any other route than it getting worse, because you know that the Chinese are going to build better and better equipment at a less price than Japanese or European or American, and it's going to drive other small businesses out of the market.
Yeah, well, if they just got out of the amateur radio equipment, I know they're still making their commercial marine equipment. They're very well established in the commercial marine radar and communication equipment. I think they just got out of the amateur radio business, which is very sad.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I've had conversations not with big companies, not big management people in big companies, but in smaller companies where I get the sense that for the most part, being in the business of selling stuff to amateur radio operators has to be partially a thing of love, because you don't make a bushel basket of profits selling to us. We're kind of tight with the wallet most of the time. So once again, this is AC2GS. Anyone out there with any likes or dislikes as far as microphones or ways of hitting that push-to-talk? I loathe Vox. I understand the usefulness of it. But I don't trust it, because I've heard too many people who sat on their push-the-talk button, and you hear what goes on in their shack when they don't know that they're transmitting, and I wouldn't want that to happen. So I'm not a big Vox person. I have a couple of foot pedals that I play with, but I always seem to go back to my Heil hand trigger. I just got used to using it, and so that's just me. And I'm a big fan of headsets. I use them most of the time, although I do have a boom screwed into the wall. I can pull it down, and I have a Heil PR40 connected to that, and I like to play with that occasionally. And there are other people I realize who just use the hand mic that comes out of the box, and it has the push-to-talk button, and you just point it to your mouth, and everything else is easy. You have no other problems, and it doesn't cost you anything. And as I said before, amateur radio operators would prefer not to use their credit cards. But anyone else with any opinions about these things, please share.
Bravo Zulu?
Yes, Rich.
Chinese radio manufacturing. I just bought my third Chinese radio, which I'm talking on now, which I've been told doesn't have very much high end to it and isn't very loud. Well, it came with a little piece of paper saying that they know that, and if I wanted to improve the microphone, the audio, add more high end to it, then I should take a capacitor and wire it from here to there. So I just laughed when I got that. I mean, could you imagine getting a $10,000 Kenwood, opening up the box and saying, if you want to make this sound the way it should, you need to wire some capacitors into the microphone. Anyway, that's my experience with the China market. As you know, Roy, back to you.
KD2FIU. Yes, George. Any $10,000 Kenwood radio is going to be a resale and you got ripped off. Kenwood radios come with audio systems built in and you use a basic Kenwood desk mic to go with it. Probably the most expensive is around $5,000. And you will have the best audio on the air, even if people tell you they have all sorts of audio system racks in front of them. So let's not put down people that have made radios for years. I just don't get that. A Chinese radio of that quality is going to be that quality. KD2FIU.
They should have put the capacitor in themselves, but I could imagine a $5,000 microphone going into a $66 dual band 25-watt transceiver.
No, not a $5,000 microphone.
No, this entire transceiver, dual band transceiver with 5, 10, 25-watt output was $66, including the microphone. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you're comparing it to Kenwood. And I'm trying to help you. While you're comparing it to Kenwood, you're not on the same track. Because when you buy a Kenwood radio and you buy a Kenwood desk mic, you don't need audio improvements. You're going to be working with the best audio sound, period. You don't need racks of audio equalization equipment to go with it. It's already there. And you don't adjust it. It's there.
Kenwood, I could have said Yaesu, ICOM, it had nothing to do with Kenwood. In fact, my favorite piece of electronic equipment I've ever had in my entire 61 years as a ham radio operator was a Kenwood 440, is a Kenwood 440, that I got tired of hearing how great the audio was, of getting great audio reports. I'm just saying that knowing they have a substandard piece of equipment and telling you how to fix it was what I got the laugh out of. That's it. It had nothing to do with Kenwood or $10,000. Go ahead. Sorry if I misled you there, George.
KD2FIU. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS. Thank you for letting me in.
You're welcome as always, George. I always appreciate your participation and Rich's and everyone who participates in the technical net. It's you guys that make or break a technical net. Me babbling to myself, I don't think people would listen that terribly long. Before we move on to a Paul space report, I just want to remind everyone, unfortunately, EchoLink has been down for the most part tonight, so we haven't had any EchoLink. People have been using my audio stream. There's about seven people who are listening via my audio stream, and the IRLP connections are alive and well. So we have a repeater linked to us in California, one in Ontario, and one in British Columbia. So I want to say hello to everyone out there and remind them that if you have any mailbag questions, topics, comments, refutations, or puzzle suggestions or ideas for Paul, you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to a lot of things that were mentioned today, an article I wrote on decibels, a nice article from someone else about signal strength meters, and some puzzle questions that I usually do puzzle questions for my other TechNet on the Kings County Radio Club's repeater, but I moved some of them over that are decibel in nature. So if you want to play around with some simple decibel puzzles, they're there for you at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, Mike, KC2NJI, has his archive site, amateurradio.tv, that archives all the amateur radio, all the technical nets going back to 2006. So keep that all in mind, and thanks everyone who participated. And now let me ask Paul to step up to the microphone and give us the space report.
AC2GS, WS2N, and thanks for all of that, Roy. And I hope everybody had a good field day if they participated at all. The bands were busy. Played around on CW and a little bit on microphone. But very interesting field day with all the one deltas out there, all the people operating from home. I mean, practically everybody you hit is a one delta. You know, there was a couple of, you know, different ones, but one delta was popular. Delta was, you know, operating from your own home. So, that's the way that worked. By the way, I like the Kenwood microphone, the desk mic. I had that for years, and it had a lock button on it. You know, as you were talking, you know, you could push it and just lock it. And now your hands are free to write something down or do something else. Let me just drop it before we go on. Yeah, main story was on Friday, 2 days ago, that we had two amateur radio operators that happened to be astronauts do a spacewalk together. They did an EVA, an extra vehicular activity, outside the International Space Station to replace a couple of these gigantic batteries on the International Space Station that have been installed, you know, from the beginning. They've been operating, charging and discharging every hour and a half for years on end. And they've worked their way from one end of the space station to the other. There's four sets of these things along the 11 trusses that hold the space station together, that support all the radiators, these monstrous radiators to get rid of the heat, and the big photovoltaic cells that are, each one's are 240 feet long and, you know, some, 50 feet wide or 40 feet wide. And they all come down to, you know, when they come down to the truss section, each area where the solar cells meet, they have these batteries and nickel hydrogen batteries, the original ones, and they have a set of 12 of them there, and they need to be replaced. But, you know, the decades are starting to go on, and they replace them with these lithium ion batteries that were manufactured in Japan and sent up by a Japan cargo vehicle last month on an HTV vehicle. And, you know, they launched their own cargo vehicle to the space station. It's presently docked. Now, you know, these batteries are massive. You know, you see them out there. Each one is like the size of a half a refrigerator. You know, on Earth, they would weigh 420 pounds. And they have to pull them out. They did a couple of them this takes, you know, each 25% of the station that's been done over the years takes about 3 or 4 spacewalks sometimes to complete. You know, they've been doing this since 2017. Here we are in 2020 and they're still doing it. Different astronauts, of course, have done it at different times. So they have 3/4 of the station complete over the years. Now this is the final group that Chris Cassidy, KF5, KDR, and Bob Benkin, KE5, GGX, were out there doing on Friday, and they worked for about a little over six hours, I think it was. And they came back in. Only one little glitch that Chris Cassidy had before he went out. He had lost one of the mirrors on his arm. You know, if you look at the spacewalks when they're out there, you'll see 2 reflecting mirrors on each arm. And one of them got away. It looks like it was probably, I guess it was Velcroed on, I'm not sure. But he must have tapped something and it floated away. So, I mean, that didn't stop the spacewalk. The idea of the mirrors are, when you're out there, you can look at your own switches and connections on your spacesuit, and in fact they have the whatever numbers that they have to read. It's actually written in a mirror fashion, you know, reversed, so that they can see what they're looking at. So that's what they're for. And but that was the only little glitch. So, but it was a successful EVA, and it worked out okay. Let me just go on to a different topic, unless anybody has a question about the spacewalk. This is WS2N. And, by the way, it was like 220 or so a spacewalk dedicated to the International Space Station since 2000. Yes, it's been up there now 20 years. So, you know, connections, the data connections and power connections and ammonia tubing connections that they need to get rid of the heat from the space station, everything's on the outside of the massive cylinders that they call it, you know, the space station, each one, you know, maybe 15 cylinders connecting to one to another, and each one is, you know, enough room to for these people to be living. It's like living in a 6-room apartment, a 6-room house. But the old, you know, they learned from the Mir space station. The Mir space station, the Russians had everything running in on the inside, and if you ever saw pictures of the astronauts floating around in the inside of Mir, the one they had up there for 15 years, you know, to go from one module to the other, you know, it had stuff all over, connecting from one module to the other, going through, they would hit everything as they went through. It didn't look good and it was dangerous. But when they built the ISS, they wanted to keep all the infrastructure on the outside. And that's why they have so many spacewalks. So, I want to talk about the helicopter that's going to be going to Mars. They have a name for it. It's Ingenuity. And Ingenuity is going to be flying on Perseverance. Perseverance is the rover, the name of the rover that will be landing on Mars in February 18th. That's the landing date. No matter which day they go off, they have to go off between the 20th and mid-August. And they have to wait a couple of days. They lost a couple of days because of a crane setup that they used to pull everything up vertically at the launch complex, Launch Complex 41 in Florida. They had to rework this whole crane setup. That pushed them back a couple of days. Now they have a contamination problem, so that's pushing them back to the 22nd of July. But suppose they get off. I think they're going to do it on their Atlas V. And they head all the way to Mars. And they go through the EDL, the entry, descent, and landing. And they come down through the atmosphere of Mars, 13,000 miles an hour. And the heat shield works fine, and the 70-foot diameter parachute opens up, and it slows them down. And then the sky crane works fine, and the aeroshell separates, and what you'll have is the rover inside. The rover will be let down on these massive cables, around 50 feet long. They'll be dangling below this, the sky crane that's got these big rocket jets that are holding it, slowing it down, and then the wheels will extend out, and then it will touch down. When it touches down, the sensors will go off and we drop it. Pyrotechnics will fire, firing these guillotine-type blades into the cables, and that will allow the sky crane to separate. The rockets will still be firing. The sky crane goes maybe a mile or two away from the landing location. And now here's this rover, Perseverance, sitting on a planet. What you have now is this helicopter that you want to release. You know, it flew all the way, hundreds of millions of miles and finally made it all the way there, and now it's only got to go a little bit more just to get onto the surface. They had to decide on where we're going to put this helicopter. You know, they had this massive robotic arm, and they said, well, maybe that's okay. We could put it on the end of that. And they said, no, that's no good. And they finally decided, let's put this helicopter. Now, this helicopter has these long blades on it, two spinning blades that are 4 feet long. And one spins clockwise, the other one spins counterclockwise. And they spin at, 2,000, a little over 2,000 RPMs. So, electric motor, of course. But they had to, fold it up and put it somewhere to, how are they going to get this thing onto the planet? So what they did is they decided, well, we'll take the whole, it's called Ingenuity, and we'll mount it horizontally instead of vertically underneath the rover. Now, the rover has plenty of clearance. In fact, it's 26 inches. So it's called a little over 2 feet of clearance between the flat bottom of the rover and the surface of Mars. Once the wheels are extended down, it's a six-wheel rover. The Ingenuity is now attached to the side. What they'll do is it'll take time. They have to check all the other stuff on the rover, make sure communications work, make sure the weather station works, make sure the camera works, make sure everything works. That'll take almost 2 months. So as 2 months go by, this rover is still sitting on the bottom of the helicopter is still sitting on the bottom of the rover, and it's got this big carbon cover, surrounding it, so that it doesn't get damaged when the rockets fire, and it protects it during flight on a cruise stage and all. So that's the first part that has to be released is this big cover, and it looks like a big, oil pan on the bottom of a vehicle. So what they'll do is they'll use the cameras to search around. Let's find a big flat area. They want to find at least 40 feet by 40 feet flat area somewhere on Mars. They don't want any rocks or anything. The rover will drive to that location once they find a big, let's call it a landing area for this helicopter. And before they go into that area that they've scoped out with their cameras, they'll release this black cover, this carbon-based cover. They have you know, that'll land onto the surface, and then they'll be able to keep going. They'll drive into that area that's very flat. With that, they'll start in motion the whole setup. They'll have little pyrotechnics go off, which will release a lever, and the rover will start rolling down. They'll have a big hinge that'll roll down 90 degrees. So it'll go from horizontal to vertical. And once it gets to almost near vertical, they have a cable attached to it and an electric motor, which will pull this hinge. It'll lock it into place, so it's perfectly vertical now. After that, they'll have, as it comes down, it has four landing legs, so two of the legs will automatically be extended, spring-loaded legs. But the other two legs will be kind of like sticking up in the air, and they had to make a hollow in the bottom of the vehicle, the Perseverance vehicle, to allow for that room. But now it's sitting vertical. The two legs are down. The other two legs will also have pyrotechnics on it. They'll fire and release the spring-loaded legs into the downward position. And now the thing is hanging from its clamp, main clamp, ready to go, and they'll be able to release that. It'll drop down about 5 inches from, the legs only will have about 5 inches to go. It'll land onto the surface. And then right after that, they'll have another set up to separate from the rover from the vehicle. They'll have, they have a data connection and a power connection. The whole time, it's been powered by the rover itself. And remember, the rover is being powered not by the sun, by plutonium. So it'll keep the battery charged when it was underneath. Because once it's released from the rover, it'll be on battery power. So right away after that, the rover will move out of the way. And on top of the helicopter, they have a solar panel. And that solar panel will constantly keep these batteries charged. They have 2 amp-hour batteries, so it's not much, but it's enough to power the motor. Also power the cameras. And if you look on the very top where the solar panel is, the solar panel is, mounted actually above the two spinning rotors. And on the very tippy top of the solar panel is a 70 centimeter antenna. So, they're really working, I think it's around 450 or so megahertz. And that's how they communicate with the rover. Rover will pull away about the length of a football field, and at some point NASA will send the instructions up to have the helicopter turn on. Hopefully this thing takes off, and as it does, there's a camera on the rover which will actually film this thing, and then over time they'll take that data and send it back to NASA, and NASA will be able to see actually a video of this thing flying on another planet. First time that would ever be done. We've had all kinds of missions to different planets, but we never had anything take off from a planet and just hover like that and then land, in an atmosphere. Although the atmosphere is very thin, the vehicle is very light. On Earth, it weighs 4 pounds. On Mars, it's roughly one-third of that. It's 3,800ths of a difference for gravity. So, this helicopter with these 4-foot blades only weighs a little, around a pound and a half. So I thought that was interesting, looking forward to seeing this happen, but it's got to take off first on this Atlas V rocket from Florida on July 22nd. Any questions or comments? This is WS2M.
AZ2PO.
I heard a station, but I didn't copy the air. Copy. Go ahead. Try that one more time, please.
Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima.
Oh, okay. AC2PL. I forgot the name, but again, the name here is Paul, and Michael is WS2N. I'm going on and on without IDing. Back to you.
Yeah, Roger, and thank you very much for the report. It's absolutely fascinating. Just two questions and one kind of ancillary question. First question being the pyrotechnics. Could you comment on the composition of the pyrotechnics, how they fire off in a thin atmosphere that's unlike Earth's atmosphere? That's number one. Number two, what is the differential lift in a thinner atmosphere, and does it compensate for they know all about the gravity and all that. And let's see, the third question I forgot, but perhaps I'll remember when you go through those first two.
Yeah, okay, the pyrotechnics, they have these little charges, and they're all over the rover itself, including the, you know, for the helicopter. You know, every time they want to disconnect something as it's coming down through the atmosphere, these things are constantly going off. I think they said there's 32 of them. I remember reading somewhere. But anyway, they have these little charges, and naturally they're set off electronically. I guess they heat it up, and it just it pops. And when it does, it moves something, and they usually have teeny tiny pistons that'll move, and a lot of them it looks like they're cutting a cable system. For instance, like I said, right before they land, they have this sky crane with eight their rockets that are firing, and they have the rockets sitting out on an angle. On it. I think it's roughly a 30-degree angle, not looking straight down, because they don't want to hurt the rover that's going to be dangling below it. And but now it's attached with cables. You know, it's going to lower the rover down, and it has to be separated. And then these things fire, and they push against the piston, and the piston has this like little guillotine setup, and that pushes. You know, that'll cut the cables. And they've been around. They said before the space program, military uses, they had them, so they've been around forever. At one point during the Spirit and Opportunity landings, before they landed, the two rovers that were solar panels, back in 2004, Steve Squires was the head engineer for it. I remember him on a documentary talking about these things. And they found out a couple of these things that were in storage weren't right. Either they were from a different manufacturer or something, and they didn't work right. And meanwhile, they had dozens of these things all over those rovers, and it almost caused a 2-year delay, because they had to open up the aeroshell and search, had everything buttoned up. They had to search for, all the different ones and make sure that they were by the right company or whatever it was, and then put everything back together again in time to launch when they did that for a 2004 landing. That all occurred in 2003. But the exact makeup of the charge itself, I don't know. I've seen different size ones that they showed on TV. and they're all, you know, on the small side. But I guess the ones that cut the bigger cables are probably larger, you know, maybe three quarters of an inch in diameter or something. And as far as the atmosphere on Mars, you know, that's, what, 0.1%? I think it's just a little bit less than that. So it's very, very, very thin air. So that's why they need these 4-foot-long blades, and they're made of some kind of carbon composite material as well. You can see they're black. And they have to really rev up. And I think I saw 2,200 RPMs or something like that. It's definitely over 2,000 RPMs. So these things really have to get going. One is, you know, and naturally it's like a helicopter. It's not like a quad, you know. It's not like, you know, like a quad we would buy in a store. This thing's like a regular helicopter. It's a square base or a cube base, cube-like base. I think it's like 8 inches wide by maybe 5 inches deep and, you know, 6 inches. So I think it's 8 by 5 by 6. And you know, in that, they have to have batteries, they have to have the motor, they have to have the cameras. And on top of that, they have the 2 4-foot blades, and I did see them tested in Ohio. They put it in Ohio. They have this, I think it's 50 feet wide by 100 foot high vacuum chamber, and they took this helicopter and they put it in there. Let me drop it. It's going back, you know, I guess a couple of years ago when they were working on this thing, and they dropped the pressure down in this mass vacuum chamber down to, you know, the same as what Mars, I think it's 0.7, roughly 1/10 of, you know, 1%, a little less than 1% of the atmosphere that we have on Earth. And sure enough, they fired it up, and the thing took off, so. They know it's going to work. You know, and they duplicated the temperatures and everything. You know, you have to keep, you know, the temperatures on Mars, you know, average temperatures is, you know, like minus 60 or something. So they have to keep the electronics warm to some degree at night. You know, daytime and nighttime, like you have here on Earth. You know, it's almost a 24-hour day. It's a little less than that, but. That's about all I know about it. Back to you. I never did get your name. AC2PL, WS2N.
WS2N, AC2PL. The name is Jeff Juliet Echo Foxtrot, Foxtrot. Yeah, that's a fascinating description that you offered. And I'm even more intrigued about the facility in Ohio. And I'll have to dig into that a little bit because pumping down a facility that large is an incredible challenge right there. So yeah, I guess the chemistry involved has its own accelerant and its own oxidant packed in to one little charge. Very, very curious. So the final question was the contamination that scrubbed the mission temporarily. Could you describe that, please? And I guess it must be a biological contamination. Go ahead.
Yeah, this came out, 3 days ago, and they said as they were closing up the aeroshell, they noticed this contamination that some, who knows, maybe somebody touched something. The details aren't out yet. So, who, you know, maybe somebody got something into where it's not supposed to be. Maybe something sprayed. Who knows, you know? I'll have to find out, but something happened as they were closing up the rover into the aeroshell. You know, aeroshell has a top part and a bottom part. The top part has a parachute and everything. So they were doing something must have, somebody must have noticed something, and then they said, that's it, all stop. Now we have to decontaminate these things. They usually heat the surfaces up to, I think it's a little over 180 degrees or something. That they have to do that. So I can imagine somebody in there with some kind of a heat gun or something, a blow dryer, on high, trying to do something to fix this. I don't know how they're going to fix it, but we'll have to see. I'm looking forward to getting that answer as well. But it costs some time. They have this thing choreographed. It's supposed to be all buttoned up and then pushed out to the launch complex. They're using Launch Complex 41 that ULA uses to launch their rockets, United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing and Lockheed together. They're the ones that work on those rockets. And the place in Ohio, I think they call it Plum Station. I think it's Plum Station. Let me drop it. They've been testing equipment there for years. They put rovers in there, full-size rovers. They put I think they put the Hubble Space Telescope in there. But, going back to the 60s, they put in command modules, the Apollo missions. I don't know if they ever tested a lemon there. The lemons are pretty big. I guess they could have done that, but that would be interesting to find out. But yeah, that's been around forever. And you could look into the history of that place. Sandusky, I think they call it. I don't know. You could find it. Put in a vacuum changer, a NASA vacuum chamber in Ohio. I'm sure you're going to find plenty of information. I could do that now if I wasn't on the net. Back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, okay, Rod. Excuse me, Roger. Absolutely fascinating information. I look forward to hearing more about the results of launch and, of course, if you hear anything about the contamination or how they decontaminated, I'm interested in that as well, especially considering everything that's going on with various biologics on Earth. Back to that. Thanks very much.
Okay, very good. And, we have other topics as well here that we could cover. But I'm fascinated with this thing. I've been waiting for this rover to take off for years. The last one that we launched similar to it was 2012, Curiosity, which is still riding around on Mars. This one's going to Jezero Crater. Jezero Crater is the location. It's like, from space, it looks like it was a delta area where Perseverance will be able to use its robotic arm and test all the different soils and rocks. They have core boring set up on this. You're going to get a little bit bigger than half inch diameter samples that they're going to drill out of rocks. They're going to be stored and eventually someday sent back to Earth on a sample return mission. So, looking forward to for this mission. And again, it's nuclear powered. It's got the RTG in the back, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. I think it puts out 109 watts and keeps the thing going, plus constantly charging batteries. Very similar to Curiosity, except a little bit bigger. Curiosity was around 10 foot by 10 foot, around 2,000 pounds, and this thing was about 4 inches bigger on each side. And 2,225 pounds, so a little heavier. So hopefully this thing gets off. I worry about Florida. Look at Florida with all the virus problems now, and the work crews and everything that are down there. I mean, they were trying to keep everybody in the, at these launch facilities pretty much isolated from the rest of Florida. Now they're really going to have to do it. They've got some big numbers. I worry about that causing a problem. If it does happen that for any reason this thing is delayed, it's a 26-month delay, a little over 2 years. the orbital mechanics between Mars and Earth. So that would be a shame. Plus, not to mention the money. I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars it would cost to put this thing in, like, temporary storage for 2 years. European Space Agency had to do it with theirs. They're not ready. They were going to launch a rover as well, solar-powered rover, but they had problems with their parachutes, so they're not going to make their date. You know, you have to get off the ground by August. China's going to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
China says that they're going to make it. They have their rocket ready. The Long March 5 rocket, which they just finally got back online. They had problems with it for a couple of years. And they're going to be sending an orbiter. And at the same time, they'll be sending, you know, with the same package, they'll be sending a lander, which will also have a rover on board that will be released. See, that's a little different than what we're doing. You know, we don't really have a lander. In the old days, we did. We don't use landers anymore. But they have a lander, and then the lander will have all the meteorological stuff on board, and then the rover will drive away, communicate with the lander, and the lander will communicate with a Chinese orbiting satellite that they're going to have. So with their orbiter, we have a different setup. We have plenty of orbiters right now that will communicate with the rovers, and when the rovers go down, you know, it's you know, when it gets released from the sky crane, the wheels touch the ground, and that's it. They're off to the races. There is no lander per se. Lander and rover are all in one. Let me drop it. See if anybody has any comments. One more topic, maybe I can get to. Yeah, there's a star called the AU Mike, or AU Microscopy, they call it. Located in Microscopium, is one of the constellations. And the star, you know, they've been looking at this, the astronomers have been looking at the star like forever. And they always suspected a planet or two being around it. And they've managed to find two, but now they found a Neptune-sized planet, and this one was found by the TESS telescope that was launched a couple of years ago. But the reason this is interesting to me is that NASA put out a poster. You know, they do this once in a while. They'll put out a poster, and in this case, it was of this star and this debris that's going around that star, and once in a while they'll put out a post that actually has, you know, imitates what they, you know, something that's real out there, and that's what they did with this one. But now it turns out that this telescope, it's the transiting exoplanet survey satellite that was launched a couple of years ago by a Falcon 9 rocket. NASA paid SpaceX to put this thing into orbit, discovered this Neptune-sized planet. So, test is up and operating for a couple of years. It's already found many planets. You know, it's got a lot of candidates, but I think 40 or so confirmed planets. And the test is looking at the nearby star system. Kepler was staring at one spot in the sky. You know, 1,500 light years away was roughly what they were doing. This thing's looking for the stars that are close, you know, Alpha Centauri, or, you know, things within 200 light years of Earth, you know, Wolf 359, and, you know, nearby stars, and looking for the planets around them. And, the transiting exoplanet survey satellite is in orbit, and not like you would think around orbit around Earth. Yeah, it's around orbiting around Earth, but it's a very elliptical orbit. You know, the apogee and perigee. It comes close to the Earth, maybe 6,000 miles away, which is not that close, but comes close to the Earth at a slow point, at apogee at a high point. It gets as far as the distance of the moon. So every roughly 14 days, I think it's 13.7 days, but every 14 days, a test goes, you know, all the way out to the moon, it comes all the way back.